Hey everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Upzone podcast. The episode you're about to hear was recorded last week in Santa Ana, California, as part of our Southern California gathering. You're going to hear myself, you're going to hear Joe Minicozzi, and you're going to hear our regular guest host, Kia Wilson. On that, I want to let you know that this is our last Upzone podcast of 2019. It's also going to be our last Upzone podcast for a while now. We kind of quite unexpectedly found out that Kia has taken a job with another organization and is departing. And in light of that, we wanted to take a little bit of time and talk about what comes next with Upzone. We all love this podcast. A lot of you have said it's your favorite of the Strong Towns podcast. We designed it to be kind of quick moving, real, you know, current events kind of focused. We wanted it to be short and succinct for people. And we really wanted it to be a mix of voices. Voices you're not going to hear on the Strong Towns podcast, for example, the one that I routinely host. We want to make sure it was a mix of kind of technical and non-technical voices. In order to make that happen, in order to make that work, we're going to take some time and figure out what the best way to relaunch Upzone would be. So keep it in your feed. Keep it in your, keep it there. We will be back with Upzone of some type, likely in the first, you know, first half of 2020. And in the meantime, enjoy this last episode. And thanks everybody for all you've done to make this podcast and all of our podcasts and work at Strong Towns a success. Hope you have a peaceful end of the year and a wonderful 2020. Take care.
As I was saying, Upzoned is a weekly podcast where every week we take just one big story from the recent news that touches the Strong Towns conversation and we upzone it. Can you tell that I have said that sentence about 150 times? Yes, I have. What we did with this one is a little special. We knew we were coming here, so we put it out to a vote. We had three stories that we said, Southern California, what do you want us to talk about? And you picked, drumroll please, bullet trains.
Yeah, so, bullet trains.
Yeah.
The most important thing on everybody's mind.
But we thought we could
not
use...
Not just bullet trains, bullet trains to Vegas, right?
Bullet trains to Vegas. So
it's a good metaphor.
Usually conferences try to end on a great big grandiose metaphor that encapsulates the spirit of the organization. We're going to end on bullet trains, and hopefully we'll get there by the end. The specific article that we're going to be talking about today is California approves $3.2 billion in bond for Virgin's $4.8 billion bullet train to Las Vegas. I'm doing some quick math in my head, and that's a lot of money. So I am very proud to be joined today by...
Let me do some quick math. Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, exactly. I'm proud to be joined by two folks that you saw present earlier. Chuck Marone, our usual co-host, and this is actually our first tripartite podcast with Joe Minicozzi. How are you folks doing today?
All right.
Good.
Very good. And I said this is our favorite podcast because we were... We had all those people who emailed us and said, Upzone's their favorite podcast. And then you were kind of like in my face about it. Like, hey, I've been doing this podcast for a year and it's more like than your podcast. So I'm like, that's good.
To be a little bit more accurate, I get emails sometimes that say, Upzone is a little better than the Strong Towns podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
I'll accept that.
Well, now we got to prove it right. You've seen Strong Towns podcast today. You tell us after this which one wins. Chuck,
yeah.
I'm going to start with you.
Yes.
What was your gut check reaction when you saw that this amount of money was being spent on a bullet train, not from, by the way, Los Angeles to Vegas, but from Victorville to Vegas, and specifically that bond dollars were going towards it? And we're going to use this, by the way, as a springboard to talk about SoCal's larger transit priorities. So feel free to extrapolate from there.
Well, I think you actually alerted me that we were going to be talking about this topic when I was driving from Camarillo to back to Santa Ana, which by the way, it took me 2 hours to go one direction and almost 4 hours to go the other direction. So I was sitting here thinking, well, what would really help right now would be a bullet train to Vegas. That's obviously the most urgent problem that people here in Southern California have. It's fascinating to me because I think if we were to just ask Californians, like list your top 1,000 priorities for things that we should do. In fact, list your top 10,000 priorities that you would do. I don't think anybody would come up with bullet train to Las Vegas. Maybe I'm guessing, maybe I'm wrong. And maybe you will all grab me afterwards and take me into a corner and say, let me tell you about bullet trains to Vegas. But I think when you think back to that four-step approach that we write about in chapter 8 of the book that I had in the last presentation, nothing about observing where people struggle, nothing about responding with any type of humility, let alone sense to what those struggles are, would get you to bullet train to Las Vegas. To me, this is just kind of emblematic of the bad project selection process that we use today. Most projects that we do, most public infrastructure projects that we do, are birthed by an internal process, a process disconnected from the real struggles of people. As an engineer, I was part of many of these processes. You can think of the metaphorical smoke-filled room. That's not how it happens. Generally, it happens is we're sitting around and there's a grant opportunity over here that we're made aware of, or there's a program over here that we can realize we can get some funding for. And all of a sudden, within our internal process, that becomes like the most important project. And then we zero in on it and we start to talk about it and we start to put things in order for it. And then when it's kind of developed, or at least kind of along the way where, boy, it looks like we could get the money or it looks like we could qualify for this, then we turn around and we start to make the case for it to the public. Here's why you really need a bullet train to Las Vegas. Let me tell you how awesome this will be. In the meantime, you're stuck in 4-hour traffic with, you know, streets that are falling apart and sidewalks that are cracked and broken and sewer and water systems that you can't maintain. And somehow there's this cognitive dissonance that maybe we do need a bullet train to Las Vegas.
Maybe we do.
Maybe we do.
We're going to settle that by the end of this half an hour. So you mentioned not every Southern, you bet if you ask 1,000 Southern Californians, actually, I'm just going to pause for a second, Joe. Do you think you could turn off your mic when I'm talking? That might be the best way for us to do this. And then I will, then I'm going to have better mic.
There you go.
Oh, so much better. Heaven. Okay. All right. So you mentioned that if you asked a random sampling of Southern Californians what their top 1,000 priorities for their state was, most people would not say, I just really want to go play Roulette Nevada right now, and I need to get there in 20 minutes. Can I make it happen? I talked to a few Southern Californians today over lunch about this topic. I gave some folks a sneak preview, and some of the responses around the table surprised me. They were like, cool, good. We need more transit in Southern California. You've talked even more Californians than I have, Joe, because in your career, you have come and you've consulted with California communities all over the place. How are transit projects like this and other transit projects, we can expand it out a little bit, perceived by the general public and by the leaders who are actually setting these priorities?
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, because can you build a train in an incremental way? Can you build that system? And how would you do that? The history of trains in Europe and in our country were all done in massive sweeps, either, you know, huge subsidies in the case of the American train system, mostly for freight and things like that.
I don't know if that's necessarily, keep going, but
keep
we can, there's some nuance with that.
But, you know, it's, but you've touched on a spot of, you know, we had the discussion both last night and today about the train line as it's come into a lot of cities. Without a lot of local input, it's just kind of just dropped in along the way, and it's been difficult for those communities to build around those train stations. It's a self-inflicted wound. So when you see something like, well, Victorville to Vegas, that's doable. It's not gonna be a lot of conflict. I mean, it's gonna cost a lot of money, but is it really gonna get the resistance of running a train line through Santa Rosa? And I think that when you're in that reality, that particularly for government works, I don't know, is Steve still here?
Steve had to go to the airport.
Okay, there's, you know, it's funny, as a former, someone who worked in government, I actually took exception to some of his portrayal of what government was like. Because it's, you know, it's not easy. I had a former boss that used to, you know, complain about government workers, and I said to him, if you ever worked in government, Like, we have a hard enough time keeping paper in the photocopier, much less some nefarious plot to destroy a neighborhood. Like, we're barely functional. And it's like, it's really hard working in government. So going after something that there's a lot of seduction in the silver bullet project or the big move that you can do without a lot of headache and a lot of grievance and a lot of, you know, not being portrayed as some hatchet man or something. So I can see the allure of it, but from a financial standpoint and then reading the article, it was really hard for me to emotionally agree with Randall O'Toole. I was having a hard time in that.
You're like, I'm not supposed to do this.
About this. But you know, I also thought he was fairly flippant with his facts, that he contorts facts and opinion together, where there's not a lot of data behind his statements.
So to catch everyone up, since you have not read this article yet, Randall O'Toole is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he said in this article, he isn't convinced that the bullet train basically is going to draw potential passengers. If you're driving from Los Angeles to Victorville, by the time you get there, you're pretty much halfway to Vegas, O'Toole said. So why would you stop and leave your car somewhere and take a train and then have to walk to wherever your destination is, or take a cab or an Uber or a Lyft, when you can just drive your car there, right?
Because bullet trains are fun.
Yeah, monorail.
Yeah.
Monorail, to quote the Simpsons. Right. That's the cadence, you got it. But I think it gets to a point that you're speaking to, Joe, about what we will say yes to in order to get something done when we are in a state of inertia. When we're saying we're a community that wants transit, we are a community that wants to have something happen. We want economic development to happen. And even if this isn't the best project in the world, gosh darn it, we're going to do it, because we haven't had, you know, Eric Griswold, one of our members here, was talking to me. He said, like, we hadn't built anything for decades new in the transit realm. At least it's something, right? So I want to start with Chuck, and then Joe, you can pick it up too. How do we get to a government where we aren't hungry for scraps, where we are reaching for the projects that people need that are going to make their basic needs easier to meet, rather than just something, anything, please, please, please?
This is where I struggle with the whole question, because it's not even like a matter of scraps. It's like the matter of, like, you can have this giant elephant or you will have nothing. And you're like, okay, well, I would really like a something much smaller. It's like, no, you will either have this or you will have nothing. And I sympathize with the people who would say, well, boy, I really want some momentum on transit. This is not the project I would pick. This is not the project that's most needed. But at least it's a project, and let's get some movement on transit. So bullet train to Vegas, like, I'm in, because I'm in for whatever will give us momentum. What I get frustrated with, and I think what I push back on, is not what Randall O'Toole, I quite frankly find his arguments on these things loathsome after a while, because they're not presented with any nuance. Or the thing I like about Upzone is I get to say what's really on my mind. I don't have to pretend to be nice. But you get, you know, he doesn't have the same degree of introspection when it comes to other, like, large top-down government projects. And that, to me, is, and I'll just use the hypocritical word, it's hypocritical, or it's at least not completely intellectually honest. I start from a very different place than that. I'm saying that we should no longer be presenting the public with the option of, do you want nothing, or do you want really, like, all this stuff ignored that really matters to you, but we'll throw this one big, like, cherry on top that you can have in your, you know, falling apart place? The reason why the subtitle of the book is A Bottom-Up Revolution is it's this juxtaposition of the top-down projects being delivered to us. And the bullet train is like the quintessential example of that top-down thing being fed to us. And you will get the activists who are saying, my gosh, I just really want transit. And I respect that reaction. I think it's wrong. And it makes me sad that we're so pathetic about doing the basic things that would make people's lives better, that we're willing to accept that. It just makes me very sad.
Are you sad, Jim Nicosi?
I'll try to cheer you up a little bit. in Portland, they started with the streetcar on the inside of the city, in the downtown. It was mostly free for a long time, subsidized, basically. But it was building that culture and that infrastructure, and they worked out from there. The Pearl Street streetcar line was privately funded by all of those developers inside the Pearl area as essentially a TIF. That system is now expanding yet again. They didn't run the train out to the airport for the longest time, and it was incredibly frustrating to go to Portland and you'd have to taxi all the way into the city to be into the pedestrian infrastructure. Well, they've grown that system once they built the trips and built the culture. This to me seems like the opposite extreme, which is you're building one really expensive thing that may take some trips off the road, but it's from these two points that you have to, one, get to by car, and two, when you're there, like, what part of Vegas are you going to with this thing? Are you going to Old Town? Are you going to the new part? Like, what's going to happen there? Is it really going to solve the trips? To some extent, you saw in over on the East Coast in Miami when they built the train system. This is where I agree with Randall, is people didn't get out of their cars because you'd have to drive to the train to get into the train. And if you're already in your vehicle, you're just going to keep on completing the trip. So, but I can also see how there could be some advantage to taking a nap for the 90 minutes on the train from you leaving Vegas to recover from your weekend or whatever. But I don't know. I guess I'd have to defer to you all because you live here and whether or not you go there. I'm not a big Vegas fan, so it's not a big deal to me with that system. But what would that, was it $4 billion? $4.1 billion. What would that $4.1 billion do in, to Chuck's point, to other choices, to other?
That's the question we never ask.
Yeah.
And it's never framed in that way. And the reason it's not framed in that way is because you couldn't actually spend, if we said there's $4.1 billion floating around out there, what should we do with it? And this is where I think Steve was somewhat correct today, offended as some of you he may have been, when he said, if the money's just floating around there, they're just gonna take it and pay down the huge pension shortfall you have. So what happens is that money can't just appear and then we have a debate over what we do about it. The only money that's forthcoming is money that comes through one of these other channels. Mm-hmm. So here's federal money that we can get to do something. What's the path of least resistance for us to do something? And you wind up then with this bureaucratic focus on that something. Part of the four-step approach that we put is to actually say, instead of orienting ourselves up to like what are these projects, orient ourselves towards what are the struggles. And what you will find is that you will do far fewer projects. You won't do a $4 billion project. You won't. And maybe that will feel like defeat to you. Maybe that will feel like not doing, the work that we should be doing. But you will do much smaller projects that have far more meaning and far more like immediate impact and cumulatively build better places. And this is like the leap I feel we need to make. Because in the desperation that we're in at the local government right now, it's very easy to just identify these flows of capital and try to position ourselves in them and then turn around and justify those things to everybody else and call that like public service. And I think that is, I'll say this kindly, not like to pick out a single person, but I feel like that is more of a self-service kind of way of going about things. It is much more difficult for us to go out and say, I am going to actually try to understand where people struggle. I am going to experience that struggle with them. And then I'm going to ask some really hard questions of myself and of my colleagues of how do we respond iteratively and meaningfully with what we have to that struggle. That's a different form of government and a different form of capital investment. But it's one that would actually amount to something meaningful and worthy of our efforts. Where I don't think a bullet train, a $4 billion, is worthy of our effort, worthy of the effort it would take to complete it.
So what is worthy of our efforts? This is the 4.8, we got the number now, $4.8 billion question. Okay. Don't you think, what do you think Southern California, in a fantasy land where it you know, I know that that this stuff from living in my town of St. Louis, where we just spent $51 million on 2 miles of trains that connects two existing stations in a slightly different way than the already existing train lines. That was cute. I dressed up as this trolley, by the way, for Halloween. It was a hit. I had like a little like dumpster fire in the front window. Like I won some costume contests. But in any case, how if we just somehow dismantle the incentive systems that make a $4.8 billion project like this seem like the only possible thing we can do. We have to eat an entire elephant or we starve, basically. Right. Right. What should we be spending that money on?
Can I pick up on this? Let's hear from what we've learned today and what Chuck talks about. Someone talked about even through a person here.
Yeah,
that, if we had a list of things, if we were paying attention to those small moves and magically this money popped up. So what's the goal with this $4.8 billion? Is it really to fulfill SB 375 and have a carbon reduction in your community? Well, if we had a list of projects that could fulfill walkability in all of our communities in the metro region, how many of those projects would be able to be funded with $4.8 billion and would the gross of all of those produce more of a carbon savings than that one train? That's all math. That's easy to solve. This is all called choice architecture in the behaviorist worlds. Do we have the right choice architecture, and are we consciously making those choices? We have a conscious choice in this bullet train. That's only one option. That's one choice. But there are innumerable choices we could be making with that money if we're ready to talk that way. Now, I proffered that one idea of the stormwater system in Eugene in my presentation.
What if you built less road and you needed less storm sewer?
Yeah.
You know, would you rather have $220 million or would you rather have low density spread out development? Because here's how you're actually spending your money.
Yeah, and we're not privy to a lot of these choices that are being decided at the default system that's all around us. And so this other thing shows up and we're like, well, let's do that. Meanwhile, hundreds and thousands, millions of choices are happening in this whole metro area that's perpetuating the problem and still driving you broke just by the current pattern. Without seeing this money that's out there, you're picking up some other bucket and dropping down over here.
Choice architecture, I think, is an interesting way to think of it. That's a behavioral economics realm. The idea that, you know, we're presented with a finite number of choices and we look at those and we debate those. But those are actually derivations of a deeper set of values. This is what I was trying to present at the end, where we had some people arguing for speed and stuff over safety and cost effectiveness. You know, there's a certain choice architecture in the way we're delivered local street design. There's certainly a choice architecture in how we budget that delivers us certain options. And I just find that palette of options to be incomplete. I think there's an interesting question, and I feel unqualified to answer it, so maybe I'll just ask it. To me, I feel like at the local level, if we were doing this ourselves, like if we had to raise $4 billion ourselves and make this decision ourselves, the choice architecture becomes, I think, more fluid and more honest and genuine, because I really fully doubt that we would choose to do that given all the other things we have. The fact that the money originates from somewhere else and flows down and we have like a local match or what have you, is there a way to change that process? Is there a way to change that? I think my default is to say local leaders need to reorient themselves and just like learn to not look at that money, that like pile of bling, and then dream about what you could do with it, and instead like hyper-focus on real needs in your community. But is there a way, and I say this in a California context because like it or not, you do tend to centralize everything to Sacramento to some degree. Is there a way to change that process where it wouldn't be necessarily the choice architecture of eat the whole elephant or starve? There could be some nuance in that. And I don't know, quite frankly, I don't know.
I don't think we're going to solve it in the next 10 minutes. Do you guys? I don't know. I do, however, I want to broaden this out a little bit, because another thing that came up that people wanted to talk about with relation to transit in California was State Bill 50, right? That's the number? Am I getting the numbers right? All of you guys in California.
Senate Bill 50.
All you guys in California just say acronyms and numbers all day, and I am tired. I can't keep them straight. So Senate Bill 50 for the national audience that will eventually listen to this. Let's summarize what it is. And I wanted to ask you guys, it's about transit-oriented development, automatically upzoning a certain radius within transit stops and dramatically upzoning areas within transit-rich, multiple overlapping lines, multiple bus service, multiple rail service, all sort of converging. That's where you can suddenly build an apartment tower where you couldn't build one before. That's my very cursory understanding of it. What about bullet train-oriented development? I'd just love to hear your thoughts on this while I got these two really smart people
this
on stage.
This is where I don't think I take issue with what Joe said before, but I think there's some nuance, and maybe I'll just highlight it, you know, about building rail all at once. When you look at rail across North America, yes, we built large rail lines all at once. The Cross-American Rail Project was one big rail line we built. But most of what we built was built rather incrementally. We took the land from Native Americans, so let's just start with that. Our land acquisition costs were very cheap for us, very expensive for them, so let's acknowledge that. But once we had acquired that land, essentially the railroads were deeded land for the railroad property, and then the railroad would go out. And the way they constructed them is they would say, here's where we're going to put the city, and we own all this land. This is where the stop is going to be. And so we're going to sell that land to speculators. And then we're going to use the money from that sale to pay for the construction of the rail line. And then people and goods are going to travel along that, and we're going to charge money for that, and we're going to use the money we charge to actually pay for the operations and maintenance. Is a very like viable thing, because you've tied the value created by the rail line to the actual capital cost of the rail line, and you've tied the ongoing operation and maintenance to the cost of operating and maintaining the line. It's very common sense. The way we do it today is we go in and we say, we don't really care about, in California, I love you all, you're the worst at this. Let's do transit-oriented development. Let's go build transit to nowhere. Not experience any of that increase in value, not capture any of that at all. Let's let private speculators capture that. Let's make it parking lots and park and rides and what have you. And then let's go back later and like wish and hope that it would develop and grow, despite having absolutely no financial incentive now to do it, or very little. And when it doesn't happen, get all mad and pass this big overarching bill to say, hey, local zoning really stinks, you all are parochial, you don't have a say anymore. And I find the dysfunction to start very, very early in this process, which was we desired transit. We went and built the most expensive transit system we could get federal money to do. And then we're frustrated that because we didn't actually connect two productive places, that people aren't riding it. And I just think we started with like the wrong framework. We started again with this kind of top down, as opposed to like, here's a place where a lot of people are, here's a place where a lot of people are, and they're trying to get back and forth and they're having trouble. Let's build like the next iteration of great transit to connect these places. That would be like incredibly successful. That's not what happened. And so now you're stuck with this underperforming system that is costing you a tremendous amount of money. You get Randall O'Toole sniping at you going, look, it's underperforming. And yeah, it is, because of the choice architecture you set it up with. I think if we're gonna have a real conversation about housing and as it relates to transit and infrastructure, we have to start talking about how we incrementally build successful places and then how we reinforce that with our transportation. Not how do we use the one pot of money that we seem to be able to get, transportation, to very clumsily drive the land use decisions we think we want. I think we have to actually invert what is driving the conversation at this point. That was my long rant. Sorry.
I want to add on to this. The thesis that I see in Strong Towns is the merging of financial information with land use decisions, where it's a seamless conversation to just talk about money, talk about real estate development, talk about speculation, and talk about planning and transportation and all these other uses, as it's all tied together. And that hasn't happened inside our world of planning.
Right.
Ever. The way that we grew into it.
I mean, in the modern era.
Yeah, there's right. The real estate people that are over at the ULI.
Well, when you and I went through the old planning books in the basement at Harvard. Yeah, we were going through old planning manuals, and they did it well then, in the 1800s.
1800s to the early 1930s.
Right.
Where they actually had value per acre. What a surprise.
It's part of the book.
And people tell me to my face today, they're like, well, that's a gimmick. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry. Don't say miles per gallon when you talk about a car. Right. But the in Copenhagen, the city actually has a real estate division that buys a boundary around Copenhagen. So they have essentially a 10-mile diameter donut that goes around the city. And they go around and buy farms. And then whenever they feel the need that the city needs to grow, they turn around and release land at market value for developers to develop. And they release land into the community and grow it up. They capture the speculative value of the land to turn around and go out and buy more property, because they're thinking about the system of the corporation, of how that thing's going to function financially. It makes financial sense. This isn't socialist. This is about the economics of cities. What you've pointed on is the fact that from a planning perspective, we disconnect zoning and transportation investments, the physical investments into a city, from the land use. And the land use folks have very little understanding about the financial systems, both of taxation, but also of real estate development. So, there's a term that when I was a zoning administrator, I used to call it the planner's gift. That if a developer could come in and convince me to change the zoning and I just change a piece of paper, I've just put millions of dollars of value into a piece of property. And that person's done very little to yield that money. This happens in every city. And particularly when you drop a train line, like every developer knows or property owner knows that, oh, you've just dropped millions of dollars at my feet. That means my property's worth millions of dollars more because I saw the investment there. This isn't rocket science. So the zoning needs to be connected with that.
I actually feel it's even more pernicious. You allude to it, the idea that you change a zoning classification, you give people millions of dollars. I saw this in my own town. We were debating where the highway bypass was going to go. Seemingly an engineering decision. But that engineering decision had massive implications for who was going to be a millionaire and who was not going to be a millionaire. And you can bet that every single meeting where this was brought up and discussed, the landowners that were essentially land speculators were there. And they were the ones with a huge, huge amount of interest in what this decision would be. I wrote about this in the book. I tell you how we make sane decisions. I get from transit advocates all the time, oh, look at Japan. They can build great like trains, great maglev trains, high-speed rail. Why can't we just do that here? Do you know what they do? We're going to build a rail out to this spot out here. We go out and we acquire at pre speculative prices all the land around what the station will be. We go like a mile in each direction. Then we put this multi-billion dollar investment in, this awesome rail line, and then we sell back the land at post-development prices, which are hugely inflated, and we take all that money and we pay for the line. But Chuck, that sounds like socialism. Yeah, okay. You don't like that? We have an American way of doing this. We have a very American way. It's in your state constitution. It derives from the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's called a general assessment. Why do you, on the 405, why do you, on Interstate 5, have interchanges every mile, every 2 miles? You're just creating massive amounts of congestion and wrecking the billions of dollars you put into a highway. Do you know why you have those? Because land speculators at each one of those have made money along the way, public money that was transferred to private wealth. If we assess those costs, like, hey, you want an interchange here? It's going to cost $400 million. Are you willing to pay $400 million? That is like in our, that's in the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That is not some un-American thing. We do that all the time. If they go by your house and they build you a new road or sewer and water, you expect to be assessed. But we don't do that for the new Walmart. We don't do that for the new In-N-Out Burger. We just build this massive infrastructure because it creates growth and development. It's a huge, huge subsidy. This is stuff we do over and over again. And I think if we grasped that, I don't necessarily think that we would, I don't think there's an option to like change how we do it, as much as there's like stop doing it. You know, I think if we actually assess this out, what you would see is that no projects would happen because none of them come anywhere near justifying the amount of money we spend on them.
Okay.
I want to point out that you've just closed the loop into real estate speculation, which is gambling, which gets us back to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
It is. The bullet train to Vegas is kind of a metaphor for transit in California. Yeah.
And with that, we are at our time. Good job, team. Okay. I want to do one quick thing. We end every episode of Upzoned with something we call the Down Zone. It's a really predictable name. We talk about usually what we've been reading, what we've been watching, what we've been listening to. We just have a little fun send off. Because we are in Southern California, I want to ask the two of you, what's your favorite Disney ride?
Oh yeah, that's very easy for me. I am a connoisseur of Disney theme parks and Disney rides. Space Mountain in California is my favorite all-time ride. If you go to Space Mountain in Florida, it's horrible. It's no good because the sound is like ambient sound throughout the ride. Here it's built into the ride itself in your ears. It's fantastic. It's timed to the ride. Space Mountain here is the best, but Hyperspace Mountain is even better. And right now, if you go to Disneyland, they've actually retooled it for Hyperspace Mountain, which is the coolest ride ever.
So, what is your Disney ride?
Well, I have to
Small World, right?
I have a Small World. I have to defer comment until, because I've never experienced the park here, so
yeah.
We're gonna do some of that tomorrow.
I'm taking you tomorrow.
So hopefully I'm gonna pick up a new ride.
How about you?
Oh, come on. You know the answer to this.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. Okay. Well, here's a hint. I'm the host of Upzoned.
Oh,
it has 13 stories.
Yeah, the Tower of
And you get to fall
terror.
Down all of them. Tower of Terror,
right.
The best ride of all time.
Yeah, I respect that.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Thank you all so much for listening into this live episode of Upzone. Thank you so much for coming to this fantastic day. We don't have time for questions, but what we do have time for is to show you guys a pretty cool movie in about an hour and a half. It's 6:30. So leave us here, get some dinner, come on back, and you will have some time to chat with us. And for those of you who are seeing tomorrow, we cannot wait to help you do what you can to build a stronger.